treason, sedition, rebellion. This is the heritage of the American patriot. Those revolutionaries who stood on principle to fight against tyranny no matter the cost. And that spirit lives strong today in the activists and freedom fighters who fight against the authoritarian state. Each in their own way, each with their own mission, united for the cause.
I had the idea to run on a platform of fuck the police prior to actually winning the primary.
AOC is a drama queen and she's full of shit.
They said, you don't get to tell us no, we're the state health department. And I said, hell no.
You brought a freaking guillotine.
People already pushing back in ways that didn't even need any votes to be cast.
I'm not ratting on anybody, and I did what I did, so you're going to have to give me what the law says you have to give.
You want to make the world a better place? Have some babies and raise them to not be stupid.
Hope I don't get canceled. Talk to you.
These are the people whose stories I'm here to share. I'm Justin O'Donnell, and this is Submersive.
Man, governments are not going to like this shit.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, activists, anarchists, shitposters, and people of the internet, thank you for tuning in. This is Subversive number 83. As always, I'm your host, Justin O'Donnell. And before we get started, just remember, whatever platform you listen on, whether YouTube Live, Odyssey, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Anchor, or on the air at LRN.fm, you can help grow the show by liking, commenting, subscribing, most of all, sharing with your friends. And if you enjoy the content, you can join the insurgency on Patreon by visiting patreon.com/O'Donnell. Again, that's patreon.com/O'Donnell. And make sure to check out our sponsor, Snack Swag, where you can get all your favorite Liberty and Subversive merch, including some official Subversive branded merch available only on snackswag.com today. Your one-stop shop for all your favorite Liberty merchandise, where you can literally wear your principles on your sleeves. Now, if you want to keep in touch between shows, follow me on social media and join our community Discord channel, where you can chat with other fans of the show at any time. All the links can be found in the description of the video or podcast you're listening to, so make sure you check them out today. And today is one hell of a day. Before we get started, just a reminder, happy holidays. Well, we're a bit late to the draw, but not to the drama. Last week, to commemorate the fourth anniversary of Senator John McCain's death, the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire made waves and captured headlines by tweeting a picture of his daughter, Meghan McCain, weeping over his casket with the caption, "Happy Holidays." Now, this annual celebratory meme, which isn't a new thing at all, it's been shared in libertarian circles and anti-war circles widely the past few years, often unnoticed and ignored, except this time. Meghan McCain herself caught wind of it, took personal offense to it, and decided to leverage every last bit of media clout she had to let the world know exactly how offended she was. Now, there's no tears to be shed for John McCain amongst the liberty or anti-war movements, but there was still backlash and anger about the tweet. Was it appropriate? Inappropriate? Well, there's no such thing as a simple answer without nuance. And when you consider messaging as a knife, the debate rages between whether to use the edge or the point. And joining me tonight to talk about messaging strategy for the Libertarian Party and the Liberty Movement as a whole, what we've done right and wrong, how we can consider both perspectives, and once again, all the way from New York, returning to the show for the first time in about a year, Eric Cordova. Eric, thanks for coming back. How are you tonight?
You know, I'm hanging in there. Got the air conditioning cranking in here because it's still summer in New York. So,
Still summer here, still summer everywhere. We're in the middle of starting our last heat wave here in New Hampshire, right in time for the leaves to start changing, and it's the worst time of year for free staters. Well, at least for me, the people who are native to New England, because the tourists start showing up.
I still remember that Family Guy episode that they did about that. The leafers come up. Yeah.
The leafers are just terrible people. Nobody likes them. Nobody wants them around. But they still show up and they still come every time. So, well, here we are in one of the most least controversial interests to the most controversial subject. This weekend's Twitter account for the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire making waves, making headlines, being broadcast on CNN, tens of millions of views, hundreds of thousands of reactions, commentary, and just anger across the spectrum on every level. You and me probably could not be on further opposite sides of like appreciation for the tweet and understanding of the tweet, but somehow are still capable to have a conversation instead of a fight. And I think that's really, before we even get started, the most important takeaway people need to have is that disagreement doesn't need to be vitriolic and angry. People can have conversations, especially your allies, your friends, because libertarianism as a philosophy of consent, we're always going to be a minority. And you don't want to be running off your friends over stupid, petty fights. But Eric, How did this really like capture your attention? Put you like, what was your thought process going in when you reached out to me when we had a chat on Twitter a couple days ago? Like, what was the buildup and introduction? Like, how did this hit you?
Well, first of all, I like to reach out to people that are that I feel I can be reasonable with, and I'm not going to like I'm a Metallica fan, but I'm not going to fight fire with fire. I know it doesn't work, so I'm not going to be one of those people. It's like, oh, you just, first of all, it's not, and I've said this before, it doesn't work when the people who are complaining the loudest are probably the closest allies. And the reason in the past that a lot of the negativity of the things on Twitter became bigger than they were is because we blew it up as a liberty movement. Like, we went, this is bad. See how bad this is? This is bad. This is really bad. And then someone outside the movement goes, you know what? It actually is kind of bad. If we just would have left well enough alone, people within our circles would have gone, that's kind of funny, or that's kind of fun. We appreciate that. And nobody would have cared. Right. The only reason that this matters is now that it made it to the mainstream, right? Meghan McCain picked up on it. CNN did the thing on it with your governor, Sununu, right?
Right.
J-Post went back and said, New Hampshire did this. Also, they did this thing, which I can speak to personally. You probably aren't looking at my name and thinking, this guy's Jewish. But yes, this guy is Jewish. And no, I did not think that was a super anti-Semitic tweet. But I can understand where people, again,
sure.
And we'll get into what is nuance and what is the average person going to understand about what they're seeing. Because we pride ourselves on being smarter than the average bear. But the old George Carlin line is, think of how stupid the average person is and realize half of them are even stupider than that.
Yeah. So I think there's actually two different cans of worms and two different discussions that you opened there. And like, while they're parallel and complementary, they are distinct and separate. On the first part is, how does a normal person see our messaging and react to it? And then the second question is like, is the normal person who we're messaging to? Like, I think that's a whole other debate and a whole other question to be had, is not how is the normal person just reacting to what we're putting out there in our messaging, but is that who we should actually be targeting and attracting? But we'll maybe circle back to that. As far as the two tweets and the subject matter, the Holocaust joke minimum wage tweet, I'm going to be perfectly honest, I didn't even notice. I didn't catch it. I was busy at work and it was deleted before and removed, and the controversy. I had thought most of the controversy was all about the McCain tweet, and it wasn't until 2 days later till somebody replied to me, no, we're not even talking about that. We're talking about this. I'm like, I didn't even see that. And I'm in the echo chamber. I am real deep in the echo chamber.
Same. And it was both. Like I said, that what sparked the fire was the McCain tweet.
Right.
The kerosene was the anti-Semitic tweet, or the, you know, the whatever it was, the minimum wage thing. And I'm not going to tell you that, you know, one was, I mean, for me, one was worse than the other. And again, I'm not an easily offended person. What I am is somebody who cares about the Libertarian Party and someone who cares about the movement and cares about getting libertarians elected. And I try to always big picture it, you know. It's not just, I feel this in the moment. This is going to be like, what's the big picture here? I'll give you an example of this. I want to tie this in. As you know, I've been active in the Libertarian Party. I am the vice chair of the Libertarian Party at Queens. In 2021, we ran two candidates for city council. One of them, on the night before his election, tweeted out a thing saying something like, my opponent is all about defund the police. I am not. And in broken English, too, because he's, you know, he's an immigrant, very much in the spirit of his district. Right. His district is like 90% immigrant, and he is from India. And so he wrote that. Immediately, libertarians jumped on him and they're like, see, we shouldn't be supporting libertarians if this is who they're running for office. Like, the guy ran an excellent campaign for over a year, actually, since he approached us. But his campaign wasn't on Twitter. This is a guy who's like in his late 40s, and he's going out into the community and attending breakfasts with people and, you know, doing the real grassroots thing. Twitter is not affecting this guy one way or the other. It's not. He had like 40 followers on Twitter, and most of them were people who were like, we should just follow him just curiosity because he's a libertarian candidate. And then they were like, oh my God, you shouldn't support libertarian candidates. They support the police. Like, he was just throwing a short differentiator between him and his opponent to nobody in particular. It doesn't matter. Like, his Twitter account did not matter. And this is my point, is that if well enough was left alone, let's say you didn't like the New Hampshire tweets, leave it alone. Then it doesn't blow up. It's not a controversy.
I remember I had really upset a lot of people. This is maybe about a year ago, last summer, when there were some controversies stewing and brewing, and it wasn't over the party accounts. It was over personal accounts, and people like myself and Reed and Jose and others within kind of our sphere being attacked and dragged by fakertarians. And I joked that fakertarians has done more damage to the liberty movement than the government, because they take everything that they think is bad, frame it in the worst possible way, and amplify it as far as they can outside of the echo chamber.
Yeah, that's just it. It's like we're taking whatever should be in here and we're throwing it out here because you need to see this. You need to see what I'm up against. No, they don't. You need to fight these battles internally. You know, this is what it's about. Like, if you're able to do that, and if you're not able to do that, how the heck are you going to take these battles and go externally? And in our case in New York, how are you going to go against Kathy Hochul and the Democratic machine? How are you going to beat Lee Zeldin and his photocopy machine? Ask me about that one. That's the real stuff that we need to be fighting. Ask me about Lee Zeldin and his copies.
Well, there's a
call about that.
Well, there is a question to ask there. Are those fights actually worth fighting? Are they actually winnable and worth dedicating what limited resources we have? Or is maybe it time to realize that 50 years of the same failed strategy trying to win at the ballot box hasn't actually produced tangible results of improved liberty where it's been tried, but maybe try and pivot and use the focus of the Libertarian Party for more of educational tool to try and affect culture and try and identify people who already agree with our ethics, our morals, and our values and bring them into activism, into awakening, because they're largely disenfranchised and apolitical for the most part, is what I find, and actually try and grow that base into a cultural movement that can actually have effect downstream, because politics will always be downstream of culture. And we've sucked at influencing culture for the last 50 years to the point where libertarianism is a bad word in 49 states. Like, is it really worth dedicating our resources to running for office, especially when us as an organization and a movement are so terrible at vetting candidates and who takes that line and represents libertarianism as candidates anyways? We can say all we want about LPNH's tweets being a bad representation, and I understand every argument that's been made against them, even though I defend them, just because I disagree. But I can say the same for some candidates that have run in New York with the blessing of the LPNY party. There was a guy who was running for governor at one point who was convicted of terrorism for trying to hijack an airplane. There was a fusion.
That was mayor.
So, mayor. The mayor of New York is honestly bigger than the governor of most states. So, there was a candidate that was elected as a district attorney as a fusion candidate who was a hardcore drug warrior.
Yeah.
Like, there have been big missteps in the representation of libertarianism across the board, not just New York. It's picked on New York because you're here, but Joe Exotic ran for governor in Oklahoma. We've had some terrible representations, even what's his name in Florida, the guy who sacrificed a goat, Augustus Invictus.
Yes.
Like, is it worth continuing to try the same failed strategy when we can't even put our best foot forward at it?
Well, ideally, I think we'd like to do that. It's just interesting that somebody right behind him has O'Donnell for U.S. Senate.
I learned. Yeah, no,
I'm absolutely just saying, you did out. But look, a political party exists for the sole purpose of running candidates for office. You can have a movement without a political party. And I think those two things, what we've tried to do is fuse them in the sense that you're talking about fusion candidates. We're trying to fuse cultural aspects with a political party. It doesn't really work. The cultural aspects can assist a party in a sense, and some people are better at utilizing that than others. And I like to draw a line of demarcation in that. And if you want to get into this, we can. The two people who really tried to do that more than almost anybody were two curmudgeon-y old white guys, Ron Paul and then Bernie Sanders. right? They wanted to influence culture to the point where it influenced policy. Not even that they, I don't even know if either of them had any real.
Well, here's the thing.
That they were going to get elected. But
I would say both of them are substantially, like, you can objectively consider both Bernie Sanders and Ron Paul electoral failures at the executive level. Like,
yes,
they were objective failures in what they were set out to do in running for president, getting elected president. However, what they accomplished was creating lasting movements that will outlive both of them.
It would have to. They're pretty old. I don't know how much, you know.
Right.
You know, I mean, they both seem to be in decent shape for their ages, but hey, listen, you know, we both know that Father Time wins all the time. But
sure. And I do believe that one of the fundamental differences between libertarianism and authoritarianism, because not just within the Libertarian Party, the Republican, Democrat Party, Democrat, Forward, Green, whatever, there's a million other goddamn parties. You're in New York, you have more than anybody. But what separates libertarianism apart from the rest of them is kind of the cultural basis. I think libertarianism is inherently different from the authoritarian philosophies in that it is philosophical in nature and that it is a ethical and moral philosophy, which guides how libertarians not just want government to act, but how they live their own lives. Like, how many libertarians do you know that their social circles are entirely other libertarians because they hang out with people who share their morals, values, and ethics? Whereas most Republicans and Democrats I know don't even know the politics of their friends outside of the election year. But they just hang out with people they share values with. And I do think that people who share the actual moral ethics and values of libertarianism are such a minority that we will always be a minority, and it's no wonder everyone coalesces together around the liberty movement. Even the apolitical people, the agorists, the mutualists, people who are just truly anti-authoritarian but want nothing to do with politics, still fall into our social circles when they're not active within the Libertarian Party, is because it is inherently cultural, where political parties of other stripes are inherently based around policy.
And admittedly, I am a little bit of a policy wonk. I mean, look, I'll be honest. I was semi-active in this movement, you know, helping out where I could, going back to 2012. What really got me more active was Larry Sharp, who is a policy wonk. Everything that he puts forward is, what is the policy behind it? What are we going to do for that, right? It's not just, I'm going to tell you what I don't like and what New York's doing wrong. I have to give you what we could do right. And I have
it's a much shorter list, to be fair.
Yeah, but I like, for me, I could grab hold of that shred because it's not enough for me to say we don't like war or we don't like this or we don't like taxes. Well, what are we gonna do to change it? Like, if you ever gave us the opportunity, what would we do? And it's great to hang out with other people, be like, yeah, high five, anti-war, bro. Like, it's great, but it's not going to actually stop war, right? Like, what actually would do that is things like, and I'll give a shout out where it's due, things like Defend the Guard. It may not end war, but it might save a lot of people from going to war that shouldn't be, right? Like, that's a policy idea that makes sense. And I think a lot of people, if they just hear that instead of let's just call out the elephant in the room. If you presented people with Defend the Guard, you know, and you say, look, it's the fourth year anniversary of John McCain's death. John McCain was a warmonger who liked to send your kids off to die. If you don't want that to happen, here's step one. Support Defend the Guard. Now we're turning it into a positive thing, right? Now we're turning into, here's what you can do. If you're somebody who has been against these things, who's like, hey, you know what? And I could speak to this personally. I remember 9/11, but we haven't stopped going to war since 9/11, since 9/12, really, right? Like, we were like, oh, this is bad. We got to go, like, change the world. We haven't stopped since then. And I remember people being on board with it then. It was popular. It ain't popular anymore. But we're still doing it because people aren't standing up and going, here's a policy that we can do. Even the epic Afghanistan thing was handled so poorly that people were like, maybe we should have stayed. No.
Pro-war populism was so popular in the early 2000s that people forget that it was the Republicans who invented cancel culture, modern cancel culture, when they tried to cancel the Dixie Chicks for being anti-war.
Yeah.
But like, yeah. No, absolutely. I agree with that 100% of your sentiment there. I don't disagree with it. I often wonder if the distinction with what there's such little focus on policy and there's such little focus, and the reason there's so much focus on camaraderie in socialization, in using the Libertarian Party as like basically a substitute for people's real life friends groups and social circles. The fact people are doing that is, I think, a huge part to blame for the 50 years of stagnation and the 50 years of failure that the Libertarian Party has seen, is because people treat it like a social club, not like a political party. So I have to ask myself, why are people treating it like a social club instead of a political party? Does it make more sense that it is a community and not a political party? If in reality, when I look at things from a 1,000-foot view and look down on my own social club, my own community, and mine's a bit different and unique, being in New Hampshire with the Free State Project, where I have active community centers, businesses, I can use Bitcoin to buy my groceries because we're so permeated here, and yet we still don't win elections.
And here, as of today, if yeah. I want to buy whipped cream, I need to show some ID. So we're living differently here in New York. Yeah. I just want to give a shout out to Kathy Hochul and her cronies for coming up with that one, keeping us safe one spray can at a time. So thanks for that. But no, I understand that. And that's why I try to keep my social circles as diverse as possible. I want to know how other people are thinking. And not only that, when I look at, and I'll give you this. So I went to Freedom Fest this year. One of the perks of being married to someone who is even better at being part of this movement than I am. I showed up at Freedom Fest, right? And I was hanging out a little bit with Marshall Burt, who's one of our highest elected officials in the Libertarian Party, right? He is a state representative in Wyoming. And he told me, he's like, look, I walked in and it was exciting to tell people they were wrong. That was fun. But then I realized I can't just spend 2 years telling people they're wrong. I got to do some right. And so he started figuring out who he could work with on certain pieces of legislation. And he was able to put together a couple and actually get one or two passed. Things that had his name on it as a tri-party sponsored legislation. Right. I don't know. Whatever the words are. To me, that's the end goal. And it's understanding we can't just go, well, we don't agree with you on this, therefore you're terrible. Like, give you a great example, Bernie Sanders, right? And his crew. There's a lot we don't agree with Bernie Sanders on, but I guarantee you that if you want a partner on ending the drug war, Bernie Sanders is your guy. He's your guy. If you want anti-war, Bernie's your guy. Bernie's been one of the most anti-war people in the Senate. So you need to know where you can partner with people. Like, heaven forbid we ever did get someone elected, or if we need to this resolution sponsored at the national level, believe it or not, he's probably in the top five of people you go to. And the point being is we can't just go, well, we hate leftists, so therefore we hate Bernie, therefore we can't work with them on anything. No, everyone has something we can work with them on. The issue is that we write people off and go, no, they're terrible. And we go, and look, I'm guilty of it at times. I say, look, you know, you're a Republican, you're a Democrat. It means you're for big government spending, you know, supporting the war, supporting high taxes, supporting cronyism. But they're not for all, each and everything. Like, there's going to be somebody who's really good on 2A that we should be trying to work with. There's going to be people who are really good at ending the drug war that we should be working with. And the issue that I have with going back to the top of the messaging, if we do too much to alienate people, we don't give ourselves an opportunity to do what Marshall Burt has already done. We're taking that opportunity away from ourselves.
Okay. Yeah, no, I agree fully. And like we've pushed the exact same thing here in New Hampshire. When we had libertarians in the state house, we had them. And mind you, like the first libertarians in New Hampshire, you know, weren't even recent party switchers. In 1992, 37 partisan libertarians were elected to the New Hampshire State House, and people don't talk about this. It's lost history to the Libertarian Party, but granted, we have that's less than 10% of the House because we have 400 House members out here in New Hampshire with the largest representative body in the world. But 37 people won elections with Libertarian next to their name in New Hampshire in 1992. Only five of them were reelected. And they served for about four terms, those five. They were popular enough to keep getting reelected. The rest kind of went on flukes. It was 92. Ross Perot was on the ticket. There was a lot of down-ballot third-party voting across the country. Green Party got like 12 people elected in Maine at the same time. It wasn't a surprise to get people in that year, but we've had tripartisan legislation. Brandon Finney kind of made the whole focus of his last term in the House as a Libertarian state rep from 2016 to 2018, making sure every bill he sponsored was tripartisan to get the best recommendation from each committee and only focusing on things where coalitions could be built. And we do have a problem with building bridges with people who identify differently than us. Absolutely. I even see that within the New Hampshire Mises Caucus, the New Hampshire Free State Project here, because everyone is so kind of culty and in-groupy, and it's a clique. Yeah. It's a social movement, not a political movement at its heart. But I do have a friend, Ellen Reed. She's a New Hampshire state representative. She is a Democrat. She's a very, very, very progressive, socialist-leaning Democrat. But she's also incredibly anti-authoritarian. And she very, very much hates the government. And she made a whole big stink last year by leaving the Democratic Party, registering as an independent, standing up on the House floor and giving a speech about how Democrat establishment was no better than the Republican establishment. And they were trying to rob the people and destroy America. And then served the rest of her term as an independent in the New Hampshire House. And then when time came to run for re-election, she went and said, oh, wait, I have to get petitions, and re-registered as a Democrat. But she has sponsored all of the legislation to reduce our ballot access thresholds, to make third parties easier, to introduce ranked choice voting for primaries and approval voting for general elections and jungle primaries and nonpartisan primaries. Every bit of election reform that we could benefit from has been her introduction and her work.
Oh, yeah? What's that like? Sorry, we're doing the opposite here.
Yeah, I get it.
I can appreciate someone doing that.
Here's the thing. We get Liberty Republicans, which are really the controlling caucus in the House in New Hampshire, because it's about a 60-40 Republican House, but when 50% of the Republicans are Liberty Republicans and side with the Democrats on some issues, that becomes a swing caucus. So the Liberty Republicans really do have control. They'll vote against her just because she's endorsed by Americans for Democracy and Rights in Democracy and two big socialist groups that are pushing. Just because they endorsed her, Liberty Republicans will vote against what she's sponsored and vote against her and are unwilling to build those coalitions and build those bridges. We had legalizing mushrooms on the ballot this year. Not on the ballot, on the House calendar. And it didn't get support from Liberty Republicans. Because it was sponsored by a socialist. So people aren't willing to build those bridges. And that's one of the things I try and do a lot, is build those bridges legislatively, because I've been around enough and I've spent enough time autistically focused on policy, like yourself and Larry Sharp, where I've spent enough time in the state house lobbying state reps on election law. I used to go to the state house to represent the Libertarian Party as an LMC member and lobby on with the election law committee on a regular basis. I've known so many of them that I've been able to build some of these bridges on small niche issues, but it's very difficult when people have an instant objection to working with somebody who they believe culturally, ideologically, and ethically opposes them.
Yeah.
And I feel like politics in general, not just libertarian politics, has gotten to the stage across all parties, libertarian, Republican, Democrat, Green, progressive, bull moose, everybody, where the divisiveness is the defining factor.
It is. And I realize that, you know, I realize you look at people and they'll tell you the reason that they're voting for the person they're voting for is to vote against the other guy. You know, this is what not only are we up against, it's just what happens in general, you know, and it's how the major parties campaign. It's not even that they have any ideas. It's just other guy bad, right? And you have to support me because other guy bad. And we're over here in the corner like, hi, we're good. We have good ideas. Hopefully we do, right? That's why we wear yellow. That's why we wear gold, right? Because it's a bright color. Look at me. We have ideas. We're going to make you freer and happier. And this is good. No. Look over here. And they're like, eh, but you can't win. That's the whole thing we're up against. But when we do win, then, as I said, the key is, can we be different? Can we break that chain of everyone's the enemy and I don't want to work with them, to I want to work with you on the stuff that I believe is going to move us forward in a good direction? Can I figure out who to work with and do that? the thing with the messaging goes back to, we need to get to that point. We need to get there. We're not there, obviously, right? We have Marshall Burt and nobody else at that level. I mean, I think we have, what, the guy, I'm blanking on his name, the guy in California who he has like 480 some odd thousand people in his thing. And
Jeff Hewitt.
District, yes. Former LNC guy, right? So, yeah. So, I mean, these are some high-ranking people. Most of our elected leaders are at lower levels, which is fine and good. I mean, you know, ultimately, I want to see, and I'm a salesman by trade. Like, I'm a recruiter. That's what I do for a living. So I want people to do that, because the way I learned in sales is try out my product. See if you like it. I feel you will. That's why I sell it, right? I wouldn't sell it if I thought you'd hate what I'm selling. Try it, and when you like it, you're going to want more of it. I'm that confident in it. That's why you should buy when I'm selling. In this case, vote for my people. I'm that confident that they're going to make your lives better, that you're going to want more of them. And that's what we're looking to do. Now, the problem, like I said, becomes, can we do that if we're running over each other within our own movement? Like, if we're not allowing each other, and look, I'm going to have some differences. If you notice, I watched your little intro video. Yep. I've watched your show before. I know the people who've been on. I don't cuss in these things. Don't do it. Do I cuss in my real life? Yes. Yes, I do. But I consider this a professional thing that I'm doing.
Sure.
And my feeling is, you know, the talk going up to this year was, it's a social club. We need to professionalize it. Well, if that's true, then we all have to walk the walk and live that, right? Whenever I show up to things, you're going to see me act that way. This is a professional organization. I'm going to act professionally in that space. At night when we're at karaoke, different story. We're no longer in that space. We're at the bar down the street doing karaoke. Fine. You know, we'll have a good time. We'll have a few drinks. We'll have some laughs. But come meeting next morning, I'm back in the suit. I'm ready to get professional. I'm ready to talk policy. I'm ready to talk what we need to talk about. It's 100% walking the walk and doing that. And my feeling is that if we're leading with and show and getting at each other's throats and putting out to the world, look, we're not professional. We're going to fight amongst each other. And we're going to see who can be the most sophomoric. I don't think it's a formula for success. That's been my opinion and my take. The only difference is I'm not going to call it out publicly. I'm right. I know the people. I'm going to say it privately to them. Hey, man, I think you went too far. You know, like, I think that's more productive and people respect you more for it. There's not a lot of respect and not a lot of love between the people who are arguing in bad faith with one another on both sides of the coin with this thing. I just don't feel it.
Sure. So I think the fundamental difference is something you just highlighted there. And unfortunately, I think this is a difference between New Hampshire and the rest of the country. And it's a difference between the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire and the rest of the country. And that's the approach we're taking, the people we're targeting and how we're trying to recruit and who we're trying to recruit and who we're trying to build, who we're trying to ally ourselves with and how we're trying to proceed towards success. And unfortunately, social media is global. Unfortunately, you cannot target a social media post to just your one state, or else we would just do whatever the hell we wanted and the rest, and nobody would care. Nobody would even notice. But the reality is, anything that we post that does well and helps New Hampshire libertarians reach New Hampshire voters and grow the New Hampshire libertarian base tends to not do well elsewhere. And that's because I think we have a different standard for who to approach, how to approach them. And that standard is that we've had success. Most of the quote-unquote liberty Republicans in other states are hot garbage conservatarians who occasionally get something right. Ron Paul inspired them, but they're more like Rand Paul than a Thomas Massie. They're not really great libertarians when it comes down to it, and they're not consistent. Here in New Hampshire, our Libertarian Caucus is not only incredibly consistent, we have multiple nonprofit political groups, PACs, everything else, holding them accountable to find actual libertarians to primary them if they deviate. Like, our Liberty Republican Caucus here in New Hampshire is actually libertarian. And our pseudo-liberty Democrats, some of the Democrats here in New Hampshire, are more libertarian than your average Republican from most other states. Our constitutional carry bill passed with support of Democrats here in New Hampshire. The opposition to mandates passed with support of Democrats. One of our legislators and an alderman in one of our big cities, Nashua, my friend Ben Clements, he is a tried and true Democrat, and he was one of the strongest voices in the state opposing mandates from the Democratic side because of how they would lead to systemic oppression and allowing the government a tool to oppress people. Like, that is a mentality we have here. We don't need the libertarian candidates in office to accomplish that. And much like New York, we also have fusion. When we have ballot access in New Hampshire, we have fusion. We can fuse candidates who are already running in the major parties to spread our line and to build a caucus in the House. There are no less than, I think, 10 Libertarian Party of New Hampshire and LP National members currently in the New Hampshire House as Republicans. They exist, including the one person I'll name because he's out, Kevin Craig, who's a Republican state rep here in New Hampshire and is Andy Craig's father. And is an LP member who's a Republican state rep here and one of our really good and consistent Liberty Republicans. In fact, our Liberty Republicans here in New Hampshire tend to be more consistent and principled libertarians while in office than Libertarian Party state leadership in a lot of other states. And I think that sets a different tone because we're not trying to market to normies. We're not trying to market to the non-believers and the average voter. We're trying to find people who are apathetic and apolitical, who are already libertarian, to awaken them up and bring them into activation within the Liberty movement, whether it's the party, whether it's the Liberty Caucus, whether it's New Hampshire Liberty Alliance, whether it's AFP. We have over 40 functioning, independent, liberty-based organizations and PACs just in southern New Hampshire that they can work with and join, all of whom we have relationships with as the Libertarian Party, and we funnel volunteers towards. So what we're trying to do is actually improve liberty in our lifetime. And we've realized we don't need to get people elected to do that. It helps us if we can have ballot access and utilize fusion as one of the tools in the belt, but it's not necessary. And that's why we keep fighting for ballot access, so we can use those tools to their fullest advantage. But the reality is, if we just market to your average voter, to normal people, moderate voters who don't share our ethics and principles but might be unhappy with the candidates the other parties have provided, they're not going to stick around. And for the most part, they don't. And what we notice is every time we have an election year, we get a surge of people coming into the party. And this isn't just New Hampshire, this is nationally. Every state party tends to have a surge of membership during an election year. Why? Because a small subset of the voting population will wake up and realize that the two major parties gave them shit and they're just looking for an alternative. They find that alternative in the Libertarian Party, and then after the election, they come to realize they're not really libertarian. The moment one of the major parties nominates somebody they don't hate, they're gone. It's more effort to keep them around and keep them sticking around, combined with the effort of recruiting them in the first place, where if you put in the effort to recruit people who are naturally your allies, not forced to be your allies, they tend to have staying power. They tend to stick around. And when you can activate them and make them feel empowered and part of the movement and part of the organization, then they're more beneficial long-term as well. And you can do more with a smaller number of people. We only have about 10 to 12,000 free staters in the state of New Hampshire. In a state of 1.3 million people, we have about 10 to 12,000 people who identify as free staters and can be arguably claimed to be free staters or libertarians active in the political sphere in New Hampshire. And yet we have active protests against us. We control a third of the House of Representatives. We control the Commissioner of Education as a free stater. The GOP majority leader is a free stater and a libertarian. And has been active with the Libertarian Party in the past. We've seen a result with a much smaller group of much more motivated and bought in people in New Hampshire. And I think that presents us with a different tactic. And to circle this back to messaging, when we do something like send the Meghan McCain tweet, I'm not worried about offending someone because we offended a lot of people. I get that. I know we offended a lot of people. However, even the truly principled libertarians who we offended aren't going to vote for tyranny in response.
Of course not. But and you hit the nail on the head with what you're saying. All this is happening in New Hampshire. There are 49 other states. Now, granted, Florida, I think, has surpassed you in the Freedom Index. So you're like,
no, they have not. We did it back.
It's close there. I think they're Although, believe me, Ron DeSantis is doing everything he can to make sure they do not get to number one. He's very much a fan
of. You have to go to the tax office to get permission to say live free or die.
But no.
If you actually read the Annex and the Freedom Index, the Cato Freedom Index that came out last year specifically said on the in an addendum at the end that they did not include any 2021 legislation or action. It was only up to 2020. And based on 2020, New Hampshire reclaimed the first spot. But based off 2021, they don't anticipate New Hampshire will lose the first spot for the next 20 years.
Okay. So, but let's assume, right, that's the way that you guys function. It's not like that throughout most of the country.
That's a problem.
Of course it is. Of course it is. But that's why when people like myself, maybe people from other larger cities or states that function inherently similar, when we say we do have to cater to the average voter, we do. We do. Trust me when I tell you, there are over 1,000, or actually just under 1,000 now, because there's a whole push in 2021 for you need to vote in the Democratic primary because that's the real election for the mayoral race. So we lost like 60 people to get us below 1,000 in Queens. So we're at like 970 or something like that, registered libertarians. Now that's teetering because based on our ballot access status, we may not even be able to call ourselves registered libertarians. Like we'll be registered other.
I understand that argument too.
But
again, it's unique because I'm about to go vote in the Republican primary in 2 weeks because that is one of the real elections and one of the most important elections. There's a state Senate seat up and there's a Republican primary between a diehard libertarian and an establishment hack. And there's no Democrat even running.
Yeah, so that doesn't really happen here. We're not going to get a great libertarian running in any of those things. That's just not a thing. So we're trying to get our party to be the representation of true libertarians. Mm-hmm. But again, 1,000 people in Queens, and Queens has 3.3 million people. Queens itself, and this is, I once got into a funny argument with this, was, people are like, well, I was running for the open seat for national for like the last eight months or whatever it was. And so I was like, well, but you've only been at the county level. You're not even, you're not even on state executive. I'm like, well, my county is 3.3 million people. Half the states in our region, which is Region 8, have less than 3.3 million people. So the stuff I'm doing is catering to a larger population than many states are. But the battle is very different because we do have to do that. We do have to understand that. And we have to try to figure out how do we get to these people, and we figure out who our demographics are. You know, who are we looking at, right? I look at my wife's mother as a great example. She actually grew up in like a Republican household, a religious Jewish household in a sense, and traditional values, that kind of thing. And her family was involved in the Republican Party. She married my father-in-law, and he over time became a libertarian. He's been a libertarian for a very long time. So my wife's actually a second gen libertarian. We always like to joke about that she was really born into it. Like I had to find it. She found it at home, which is nice. But her mother over time was seeing what we were doing, going, I like that. I don't like that. I like that. I like that. And the thing that put her over the edge was the motherly instinct of when they put the chains on the fences so the kids couldn't use the playground during COVID. And I looked at that and, her mom is of mother age of someone who would be, who would be whatever. Because I've told you don't give away a woman. I'm not going to do that. But people who have children who felt I can't have my kids play on the playground that didn't buy into this stuff, that were like, wait a minute. You're taking away my ability to decide whether or not it's okay for my kid to play. Not even that I'm afraid of COVID, I'm not. But this idea that you don't think I'm smart enough to figure out whether this is a risk I'm able to take with my family. Those are the people that we said, hey, we should be cutting the locks and chains off of that. That is a step or 15 steps too far, right? And those are the people, by the way, who vote. And that's the point that I try to drive home to everybody. And I remember sitting at a bar in Forest Hills with Vermin Supreme. I'm going to name drop that name here. And he was telling me that he's going to get a quarter of all college kids to vote for him. That's why he should be the nominee for president in 2020. And I said to him, you're lucky if you can get a quarter of the kids who are currently enrolled in college to take a bong hit if it's 5 feet away. Yeah. You're not getting them to go out to a voting booth and vote for you. I guarantee you a quarter of them won't vote. Like you can't get a quarter of them total to vote, let alone all for the same candidate, let alone one that's a libertarian, let alone one that wears a boot on his head.
So the question you have to ask, though, I don't disagree with you, parents. Parents, people who are very family-oriented, they are a key kind of demographic that we've seen shifting over the last 2 years with COVID. But how do you retain them? But how do you retain them when 4 years from now they've all forgotten about COVID, we're on to the next big thing, and their favorite Democrat or their favorite Republican is running again? Like, how do you retain them, the ones who came over on an issue, not on principles, and kind of weren't at home? And to further on your point, I think the Jewish community is actually a very undervalued target for recruitment. 100%. Amongst libertarians, I mean, there are people with history of oppression at every level in every country across the globe. They have a fundamental understanding of what it means to be oppressed, not just by the government, but by businesses and communities.
But I'll
and
go they're a also step a very, further. Let me go a step further with Jews.
They're family oriented. They're community oriented. They
community oriented
homogenize their communities.
Yes. And that's one what thing, I want to talk about.
Because one thing I noticed when I helped start the Free State Project podcast, Free State Live, and I was looking at our data about downloads, and after the first 15,000-20,000 downloads, I looked at it, I'm like, 80% of our first-time listeners are coming from Israel.
Huh.
And then we had a huge spike in refugees from Israel to the Free State Project in the past 2 years.
Well, think about it, right? In Israel... And I'll even talk about it to an extent in New York. In Israel, they have places that you can live that are basically free from the government, either on a moshav, which is a rural commune, really, you know, is what it is. My cousin lives on one, so right. I can kind of speak to that. They basically run their own ship out there, and they're not subjected to anything. Like, they share their food, and the food isn't taxed. Like, they can just share food amongst each other, and it doesn't have to go to the supermarket first, right? And the kids can just share their spaces, and they can go play, and they have their own school on the moshav. It's the same thing with the kibbutz, right? They have internalized their communities. Now, take that to the United States. We have religious communities in New York City, and I think that there are some of these like around the country. They have their own schools. They have their own place of prayer. They have their own ambulances. They have their own hospitals, and they've figured out a way to get all that done without taxes. All these things that were claimed, you can't do those things. This is why we need taxes. This is how you live in a civilized society. Well, the Orthodox Jews have figured out a way. And not only have they figured out a way, but they've worked around all the potential problems, right? The easiest problem people would look at is, well, what about Shabbos? It's 25 hours where you can't drive a car. How are you going to drive a thing? And they figured out the solution to that, to how you're going to make that work. So it still serves their community, and they do it. And I watch it in action, and it works for them. And I've talked about this with other Jews in the movement. Those are people that vote almost 100% Republican. And the reason? Because Republicans come off as more pro-Israel. That's it.
Yep. Well, here's a
but our principles actually would stand more with these people. We'd say, hey, absolutely, we support your right to be that community. Whereas let's look on the other side of it. Bill de Blasio was blaming them for COVID.
Yeah.
And he was like literally saying the Jews, which was ridiculous. And by the way, good luck, Bill. He apparently got a job teaching at Harvard, so don't go to Harvard.
Well, I mean, Elizabeth Warren has tenure there, so I mean, it was already a bad shot.
Right.
To that point, though, like just to harp on it, just to harp back on this, the Jews have managed to create these functioning, autonomous, anarcho-communistic, I hate the word communist, anarcho kind of like mutualistic societies within our societies that live by ignoring the government, doing their own thing, operating autonomously both here and in Israel. One of the thing that binds them, the thing that makes it all work, how they're able to do it, is because they have a shared culture. And so this goes back to my point. If we're recruiting people into our movement who don't share our values, the ethics and morals of consent and like the fundamentals of libertarianism, respect for property and consent, how can we expect any kind of political success to be sustained long term. We might win an election, but how do we win re-election long enough to make those policies become effective and have people see them through if you're not surrounding yourself by people who share your values? And slight little pitch for the Free State Project there. I think that's why we're succeeding, is because even your typical native Republicans and Democrats in New Hampshire have a slight bent of libertarianism to them. It's just the culture of the state. And that's what made the Free State Project able to have success here. And that's what's created this unique circumstance for a much more successful libertarian party when redefining success away from winning elections to influencing policy. Like, and the Jewish communities in New York and in Israel are the perfect example of that. Another being the Kurds in northern Syria, who do the exact same thing and operate autonomously. Or the Catholics in Spain, they have a bunch of autonomous communes in Catalonia and in northern Spain, where they're just free from government control. Or the Basque region of Spain, which is an entirely autonomous, self-governing, anarcho-mutualist society on the border of Spain and France that the government just doesn't touch. Like, these places exist, but what makes them successful is cultural homogeneity and ethical homogeneity. And God, I'm starting to sound like Hans Hermann Hoppe here, but like, how do we live with people who don't share our values?
Well, we almost have to. I mean, you're never going to live. It's very hard to do that. Like, I understand that certain people have found their niche and figure out a way to do that. But then again, they really have a different set of values, right? Like, and I, again, coming from someone who is Jewish and actually is culturally and religiously Jewish, like, if I panned over my camera, you would see I have the Shabbos candles, like, right there. And, you know, the Kiddush cup is in the curio. And, like, I have a mezuzah on my door. Like, I genuinely live these values. Like, I'm not just making this up, but I don't live the way that the Orthodox live. You will find me breaking Shabbos. Like, I'm not going to be, you know, sitting there reading a book with the lights off. Like, it's just not the way I live. And I'm okay with saying that. Like, I've chosen my path of how I'm going to do that. But the point is, I also live in a building, in my apartment building, with people of different faiths, come from different parts of the world, and I live among them. And the easiest way to do that is mutual respect. But I want to look at this from two different lenses: the movement and the party. Because we've been talking about that, and they've been interwoven. The movement and how you recruit for the movement are people who are going to share your values, who really are going to latch on, and they're going to be your foot soldiers. They're going to be people who are there with you. Like, yes, I agree with all this. This is amazing. I'm so glad I found this. The party operates in a political way. We need to win votes so we can win elections. That's what the purpose of a party is, as we said at the top. What I need are the people from the movement to help me win votes for the party. I need those boots on the ground. I need them knocking on doors, being passionate about what we're doing. I'll give you an example of what I've explained to people. We saw this happen in Queens with AOC. Mm-hmm. Okay. AOC was a political outsider. She had the backing of the DSA, but at that time, the DSA was not that powerful. This is 2018. And she knocked off someone who was very powerful within the Democratic Party. I don't want to say that lightly. Like, Joe Crowley was a big time player in the Democratic Party. Like, he may have been Speaker of the House by this point if he would have stayed there. He was that powerful within the party. How did AOC win? Now, I know people are hearing that name and they are like, the cringe is happening. And
I love her. She's my favorite big booty Latina.
Sure. Why not? I was hopeful. I'll tell you a funny aside. I was hopeful I was going to meet her, actually, because on the other side of my wife's family, it was her her grandparents on her father's side who had been involved in the Democratic Party for like many, many years. Her grandfather was like the president of his Democratic club.
I met her once when she was in college before she was a congresswoman. She went to Boston University and she stumbled into a Boston Austrian economics meetup. She's not as dumb as she makes herself out to be when she makes these committee hearings and whatnot. Man. It's all an act. She is brilliant and she knows exactly what she's doing.
That's what I try to tell people. I feel that, and you have to, if you're gonna organize to beat this guy who's popular in his community, right? and you're going to somehow figure out politically how to beat him. And the way that they won, they got boots on the ground and they knocked a ton of doors. They spoke to a ton of people and they were like, wow, this young woman is very passionate. Joe has been doing his thing, but he's not really in the community so much.
Right.
And listen, neither is she anymore, because now she's like a national politician. So she's not hanging out in the community and people feel abandoned by that. This is the nature of politics, but she got the job done for that reason. And now, and this is, I think, the difference between the Ron Paul movement and the, at least at the top levels, the Ron Paul movement and the Bernie Sanders movement. Bernie Sanders movement, in my opinion, influenced policy a lot more, because it just, they were better at getting the ground game organized. The people that they brought in were willing to go out there and knock the doors and do those things at the time. And they were able to get some of these people in. And those people, even though they are a minority, they are pushing the Democrats to change their policy ideas. They are very much doing that. And they've been successful in doing that.
And it's been their radical messaging. It's been their radical messaging that's been activating and aggravating their base. And like, it comes back to I think the radical messaging is very important to activating and aggravating a base and getting them motivated to make these changes. I think the fundamental divide between LPNH and the rest of the LP right now is who they're trying to influence. You're trying to influence voters, but we're trying to influence legislators. And we're trying to motivate people and anger people to the point where they're influencing legislators. Like, we didn't feel the need to put a whole big spiel about defend the guard on the tail end of that Meghan McCain tweet, because everyone we're reaching already knows about it. And we have a big rally planned on September 11th, and we've already lined up 100 people to testify and 12 legislators to sponsor the bill. Like, we don't need to push it. It's already in progress, and everyone who is aware of it got the message.
Right. The problem is that with Twitter,
how do we bridge the gap? That's I think fundamentally what we want to come to, like, and if not an agreement and understanding on, is how do we proceed with respecting the fact that the different strategy is working for New Hampshire, and try to not harm other people.
Yeah, the problem with Twitter is that there's no way to really limit it to only reaching the people of your state.
Right.
It's, you know, it's just an entity that exists. It's like if you, and this is not as popular back in the day, you ran a TV commercial. That's only going out to the people in your area. Like, you're not going to be like, I'm not going to air a commercial for my candidates in New Hampshire because you're not going to vote for my candidates. You don't live here. But you can't really control who sees your tweet, right? Now, if a commercial was that offensive, would national publication pick it up? Yeah, maybe. Maybe. You know, they would paint it as, oh, look at what this party is doing. I think that may be true. But it's very rare that happens, because people understand the medium is television. And they understand there are rules around television of, like, things you can and cannot say, right? That, again, I'm a big George Carlin guy. The 7 words you can't say on TV are like the 87 words you can't say on TV at this point. It really is. But we know that. And we know that the TV stations aren't going to air what you want to put on if they don't like it. They have the right to do that. They're a TV station. They don't have to air your ad. Whereas Twitter, all it takes is me picking up my phone, going like this, and it goes out to the world. You know, it's personal responsibility, which is something we preach as libertarians, is that it should be about personal accountability. It's up to you to decide what comes out from your entities. And that's why I try to draw a line between my personal stuff and my professional stuff. Now, granted, I treat my Twitter account as a professional account because it says Vice Chair LP Queens in there.
Sure.
If it didn't,
mine says verified shit poster.
Then that's what you're going to be doing. And, right. You know, the difference is I'm saying I'm representing this organization. I've always understood that inherently. Like, when I put myself out into the world, I am representing any of the things that I'm a part of, right? I have a chat group amongst friends where we have everything from a Bernie bro to me. I'm a minarchist, borderline anarchist, right? Like, and everything in between. I got a guy who's running for city council in the next couple of years as a Democrat. We have a Trump Republican, and it's a cool thing because you get to see everyone's perspective. But the reason that it works is that we all like each other at the end of the day. Like, it's not like we're like, oh, politics, you know. It's like we want to hear each other's ideas. And they look to me when there's like libertarian stuff going on to find out. By the way, you know how many times they brought up your tweets?
Mine?
The LPNH.
Oh, sure. LPNH. Because I've gotten mine. I've gotten mine brought up.
They haven't brought it up. And believe me, every time that that Glenn Jacobs, Kane, yep, you know, says something on Twitter they don't like, oh, it's in the chat. Because they know that A, I'm a wrestling fan, and B, I'm a libertarian. So, like, it's going to attract me to the conversation. Right. But no, they're not even aware of the New Hampshire thing. So, like, we're obsessed with something that the average person isn't really aware of.
Right, because it didn't actually break the echo chamber. It broke the echo chamber of libertarianism, but it only got out to the echo chamber of the politically active, yes, which is still a very small minority of Americans.
Yeah, so that's why I do think that overreacting to it, look, I understand reacting to it in the sense of how is this going to affect our people that are active in the movement? How is it going to affect our donor base? How is it going to affect our candidates who are not saying those things, their ability to run there? Like, are they being affected by it? And I've had conversations with candidates in those terms. It'll come up every now and again. Oh, didn't I see that you guys are like this? And all it takes is, well, not you guys. That was a particular candidate or a particular thing, and I'm running a different type of campaign here. If you actually have the ability to say those things and get the time of day, you'll be fine. You know, I mean, no one thinks of, I don't think, at least, no one thinks that every single Democrat is exactly like AOC or Ilhan Omar. They don't, right? Because they're not. I mean, well, I can
tell some of my coworkers do.
No, I can tell you. I mean, you know, just again, AOC is over in Astoria. In my district, it's Grace Meng. You know what Grace Meng's about? Neither do I, because she's like the quietest person ever. She doesn't do anything. She's just a party shill. But she's not making waves because of that, right? Like, she just exists as the person that keeps getting elected to Congress. So it's not like we're like, oh, Grace Meng is exactly like AOC. No, she's not, because you never hear from her. In fact, try writing to her about Defend the Guard or anything else. You're not going to hear back from her. It's not going to happen. And when you do, it's going to be one of her staffers that can't really put together an email. That's what's going to happen. I'm telling you.
That probably describes about 400 of the 435 of them in D.C.
Right. So but, you can't, you know, you have to just be like, hey, listen, I'm functioning the way I function. I'm not. That's not me. So don't worry about what they're saying. Just worry about what I'm going to say and do. And if you can have that, you're fine.
Well, while you're talking about the candidates of other parties, I mean, let's even talk about the candidates of our own and tie it into their messaging and how diverse and distinct messaging for candidates even has to be across the country. Like, Larry Sharp, you're right. He's one of the smartest people I've ever worked with, and he has a policy for everything. His policy team is fantastic. Mm-hmm. He's assembled some of the most autistic people in the Liberty Movement to sit down and write policy with him, and he has great policies. I've had him on my show a couple times, and we've talked about his policies and how intricate they are. That doesn't sell here in New Hampshire.
Right.
The Massachusetts libertarians, they're the old Libertarian Party of Massachusetts, not or the current one. Who knows? I still don't know which one is which in Massachusetts, because the state affiliate doesn't have candidates, but the old party does. The Libertarian Party of Massachusetts is running candidates. Their candidates are incredibly pragmatic, and in New Hampshire would be considered Democrats, and I have to apologize for them. Whenever we're petitioning in border towns where 80% of our population lives within 20 miles of the Massachusetts border, and whenever we're petitioning in border towns and talking to people, I have people complain about the libertarian messaging in Massachusetts. And it's like, that's not libertarian. That's not pro-freedom. Libertarians are just liberals. I'm like, well, no, just because Ashley Shade runs constantly on nothing but trans rights, that doesn't mean that's the entire platform of the Libertarian Party. Like, let's talk about the other things. Whereas I get messages from libertarians across the country complaining about Jeremy Kaufman and how much they hate Jeremy Kaufman and how he's destroying their chances and ruining races in other states. Meanwhile, I go into work where nobody who works with me is a libertarian. They all have inklings of my following and whatnot. And I'll have my boss, the owner of the company, come up to me on a lunch break. Hey, did you see this hilarious video? This guy's running for Senate. It's amazing. Showing me the War is Gay ad and how amazing it was, because it just got that reach on its own here in New Hampshire. And people liked it and enjoyed it. Whereas I have another coworker of mine who worked for one of the Republican Senate candidates quit his campaign because of Jeremy Kaufman's videos. and how much she liked them instead. Like, they are having a tangible community effect here in New Hampshire, while I'm getting other people complaining about how awful they are. So I like, how do we get not just people to realize that, like, I think every state needs to be better at amplifying their own message. Then if New Hampshire is going to be a problem for them, well, we're doing what we need to do to have the success we're having. Shouldn't it be incumbent on every state to amplify their own message to the point where Dan Fishman, with the man who recruited me to the Libertarian Party, used to say the solution to pollution is dilution. If there's a bad actor, drown them out.
Yeah.
And if you think New Hampshire's a bad actor, be louder so nobody near you hears them.
That makes a lot of sense. The easiest thing to do, though, is to just complain and not do anything. And I've said this about a lot of things within our movement. People enjoy complaining more than they like doing stuff.
That's not our movement. That's humanity in general, I think.
Yeah, but it's certainly evident here, right? Like, you know, we had difficult ballot access restrictions in New York, as I mentioned earlier in the program. And people just wanted to sit there and complain about how hard it's going to be, or, you know, and I will say this, I went to Boston actually to fight for us to get money from the LNC, and that was a struggle, and there was a whole bunch of stuff that happened. I don't want to get into it, but the fact is, like, I went and took action. I'm not trying to do that to, like, pat myself on the back, but I am saying I was a nobody at that point. Like, I, you know,
right.
who am I to the national movement? And I said, I'm going to show up, and I didn't think I was going to say anything, but it was there, and I felt compelled to speak up, knowing that my region reps were fighting for us, but they weren't quite speaking to New York because, you know, full disclosure, one was from New Jersey, that being Rich Bowen, and the alternate was Pat Ford from Rhode Island. Both nice guys. Neither of them are from New York. Neither of them really understood what we were up against, what we were planning, any of that kind of stuff. Hearing it from us, and it was myself and Tony D'Orazio from New York that spoke out, it's like, okay, these are the people on the inside that understand. Now, the reality of it is, yeah, if you are running in a race in, I don't know, West Virginia, and you think that New Hampshire is negatively affecting your chances of winning, you do need to find a way to reach more West Virginians and figure out what's going to work there, and reassure the 7 West Virginians that are probably offended by the thing. Now, with that said, I do think that there is a line of professionalism that I wouldn't cross as far as messaging. Like, I'm all for being bold and assertive and cheap plug. You know, I tend to do that in a more vague way. On my accounts, which is at LP Power of One, so cheap plug there. But I understand that there are people who operate differently than me, and I respect that. What I think the line for me is, if you're going to operate from either putting what you're doing in your bio, or it's going to be the name of the account, meaning like your state, national, your county, whatever thing like that it's going to be. If you're going to do that, then there has to be a line somewhere that you know that it's just not a reflection on me. It's a reflection on my party, my organization. And there is a such thing as too far. Like, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have the ability to really speak out on issues we're passionate about, but I do think there's a point where it's like, and just going back to the original thing, right?
Yep.
People are going to take what they see and make a decision like that. They're not going to sit there and examine the nuance, especially people who are not libertarians. Like, if I showed this stuff to my group, which, by the way, they're not aware of, as I said, but if I showed it to them, they'd be like, Jesus Christ, dude, you hang out with these people? Like, that would be their immediate reaction. A day later, I might get a message from one of them going, actually, it's kind of funny. But like, the immediacy would be, damn, that's bad. And the last thing I want to touch on when it comes to that is, who are your allies, right? And this was my concern at the beginning, because what was pitched to me was, well, we don't get traditional media, so that's not our allyship, right? Joe Rogan and Tim Pool and Jimmy Dore, whoever these guys are, those are like, this world is what's going to get our message out. Well, okay. But Tim Pool hated it. So what I'm saying is, if you piss off like the few people that are willing to give you a much larger platform than our own to get, get your message out there, that's probably bad. Like, no one wants to put us out there because they're like we get Kennedy. That's all we get. Like, on television, we get Kennedy. Nobody else is putting us out there. Notice how CNN had Sununu on. Notice how they didn't have a Libertarian Party representative. It ain't happening.
Yeah, well, I mean, to be fair, there was a little bit of bad timing with CNN where Sununu was already scheduled for his interview about the elections anyways, and it just happened to be another touching point to add. And Sununu has done his very best to lose the Liberty vote in New Hampshire. A lot of people have said to me, I think the Libertarian candidate for governor in New Hampshire is going to blow people's minds with the percentage this year, just because of how many people are upset with Sununu, and he's still going to win in a landslide. But that's just how much people hate the Democrat that's running, as he's somehow the worst of the three or four. We have two Libertarians running in New Hampshire for governor.
Right.
But here's the thing. Circle this all the way back to the knife analogy I made in the introduction. The edge of the point, which is more important than the edge cuts, the point kills. Right. And that's a big distinction people need to make. The Libertarian Party candidate for governor polls at 8%. The other Libertarian running on a platform of respect and peace and being nice to everyone, there's four results on Google for her name, and they're all 10 years old. Nobody knows who she is. And she has far more money. She has a far more professional and experienced campaign team. Nick Sarwark's team is managing her, and nobody knows who she is. But the candidates running on bold, edgy messaging are polling at 8% or higher in internal push polls.
Well, like I said, that's obviously working for New Hampshire.
Right.
Do I think that those same percentages would hold in New York or New Jersey? I don't. And I think any of us being honest with ourselves would agree that they don't. Who polls well in New York? Larry Sharp, right? Larry Sharp's first poll was 6% in New York, which is a pretty big deal given the size of our state and given the usual political leanings here. Do I think that your candidates could poll as high as Larry here? I don't. And that's what I'm saying is you have to, like, New York is not worried about what your candidates are doing.
Because they're doing their own thing. And I will give New York all the credit in the world. They're my two terms of the LNC. I talked to the New York State chair or vice chair. It was mostly Tony DiRazio. Probably I talked to Tony as a friend very frequently during that period of time. But as far as my being the Region 8 rep and Tony being state chair of New York, I talked to him maybe twice or three times a year. And it was, hey, Tony, I'm filling out the region report. Does New York need anything? Nah, we got it handled. New York's great. Back then, there was never any problems until Larry Sharp pissed off the Democrats enough that they decided to get rid of your ballot access.
Yeah, well.
But, like, I will give New York credit for, like, always being on top of doing their own thing.
But I'm not – I don't want to just, like, use that as, like, a platform to try to promote what we're doing. Like, because what I'm saying is you have the ability to drive your own car no matter where you are, right? If you – are doing that and you understand who you're, and not just at the state level, right? We're talking a lot about that, but you know, are you running someone in a congressional district? We unfortunately lost that candidate due to ballot access. That was Jonathan Howe. And I made a big
incredible. And really those of you watching here or reading afterwards or listening to somewhere else, go back a couple months in my catalog when Jonathan was still doing his petition and trying to run. I had an interview with him about working inside the family court system. And it is one of my favorite interviews I've ever done. Jonathan is incredible. I didn't even know that the family court system had defense attorneys. They had public defenders for child protection cases until after I talked to him. So I learned so much from him. He's incredible. And hopefully he runs again in New York.
Yeah. I mean, I'm hopeful for that too, because just again, and that was part of we're trying to do the right thing. He came to us. He found us as, hey, I've always felt I'm a Libertarian. I see that you guys are running things in a way that I want to be a part of. I actually want to run for office. Awesome. We were able to provide that for him. The state took that away. I mean, long story short, without getting too far into it, he got like almost half the amount of signatures he needed in about half the time that he had. And then they said, yeah, those don't count because they're gerrymandering. You have to start all over. He's like, well, I took off of work. I got my people involved. And, like, they can't take off of work again. Like, we were doing this thing and you raised the bar. He's like, I just
halfway
through. I don't know that we're going to make it. So, yeah, it was a tough blow for him, for us, for everybody. And the biggest reason I think it's a tough blow is Jonathan was running against AOC. I brought it up before, and this is why. I think understanding why she was successful and then running a candidate against her, a lot of people felt, well, our candidacy should be she's the worst, she's terrible. No, the Republicans going to do that. That's their entire candidacy. They have nothing to say, the Republicans in that district. The entire thing is AOC bad. Jonathan was saying, no, actually, AOC's got some good ideas. She just doesn't always go about solving them the right way. You know, a clean planet, that's a good idea. Like, we should do that. How do we do that? Well, the libertarian way is, like, way better than her way, right?
Right.
You know? Like, how do we go about achieving justice? Well, actually, I work within the court system. I know how to do that and hold people accountable in a libertarian way, right? Like, that was his campaign. That may not work elsewhere. But yeah. In New York,
in
Queens, it was working as a message. So the thing that I would say to everybody is this, and you can take with it what you are, but I understand that not every place is going to be the same, and you do have to cut a little bit of slack there. But I'm going to say as a whole, though, if what you're doing goes beyond that, take a deep breath, okay? Just Twitter. And 99% of the time, I say it's just Twitter. Even the 100% of the time, which was this, where we, like, get on national TV and we're being mentioned in a negative way, it's still just Twitter.
Yep.
Okay? Take a deep breath. It's going to be okay. And if you're that concerned about it, go find candidates. Go put them out there. Control your narrative. It can be, you know, I know that can be done because we did it. Literally, just a schlubby Jew like myself, my wife, my father-in-law, and, you know, a guy who is also an attorney. Like, we started this thing back up, and we did it. What did we know? You know, we were just like, hey, we want to, like, offer up candidates that speak to a better message and would bring better things to the county of Queens, running in city council, running congressionally, whatever it is. We want to put people out there that give you an option that you're not seeing. Because here's what you're getting. You're getting the establishment Democrat. You might get the Democratic Socialist running in a primary. And then you're getting MAGA. Because that's what the Republicans think is going to win New York because they're stupid.
They're always stupid and terrible. But all right, well, we're running up and out of time. Before I pass it back to you for final thoughts, just to harp back on that whole last point you made. Another candidate, another great libertarian in the chat. We got Mayor Kate from Pennsylvania saying the LP should bring up more issues of family law more often. And that's the role of candidates to bring up. Absolutely. And they should bring up far more often because it's one of the biggest issues that we face. But I don't think the strategy that's working for you guys in New York would not only not work for us in New Hampshire, it wouldn't work for Kate in Pennsylvania. I don't think the strategy we're doing in New Hampshire will work for you in New York, and it won't work for Kate in Pennsylvania.
Right.
And what get Kate elected mayor in Pennsylvania wouldn't work in Queens or New Hampshire. Right. All politics is local. And that was one of the first things I learned when I started to get involved back in 2015 from a great guy named Tom Simmons, who was running for Congress in Massachusetts. He's now moved up to Vermont, was that all politics is local. And you need to cater not just your messaging, not just your strategy, but every last bit of your campaign to where you're running and to your locality, including what you consider a win and what you consider a long-term success. And so, like, what's local here in New Hampshire is not local in Queens, it's not local in Pennsylvania, it's not local in Iowa. So amplify your own message and do what you need to do to win where you are. And if you get tired of trying, the Free State Project will always welcome you with open arms to join us here in lovely, beautiful, free New Hampshire. Eric, any final thoughts for everybody?
Yeah, I'm going to piggyback on Kate because I gave myself the cheap plug. That's all I'm going to do at LP Power of One. That's where you can find what I have to say and what we're doing. But I actually want to give a shout out to my cousin, Advocates for Children in Atlanta, Georgia. And the reason I bring that up is this. Kate mentioned we should be doing more and talking about family courts. Well, here's what one person did, and that is my cousin, Sarah. what she did was she noticed that, and she was advocating for families. When kids are taken away from their families, it's not because of abuse. It's not because of neglect. Most of the time, it's because of poverty reasons. The state is deciding that, well, these people don't make enough money for the kids, and we're going to take them away, and we're going to put them with foster families because they're going to be treated better there. They're not. They're going to be given better food and clothing. They're not. They're going to be doing better in school. They don't. So what my cousin has done is she's become an advocate for this, number one. And number two, she started a nonprofit outside of the purview of the government who's trying to provide for these people under the welfare system. The nonprofit, they raise money and they take donations of clothing, of bottles, of anything that can help families give the things necessary to give to their children. I've seen them do it. They have the kids go in, and it's literally like walking into one of those children's clothing stores, and they go around, they pick something out, and they get donations from all sorts. Like, kids get super stoked, like, oh my God, I can wear an Under Armour shirt. This is amazing. You can do that with nonprofit and mutual aid by living libertarian. My cousin isn't even like a political activist, but when we talked about being libertarian, she's like, that's what I'm doing. I'm living like what you're saying.
Culturally, ethically, yeah, and morally.
Do that. Advocates for Children is a phenomenal organization, and there should be one like it in every major city. There should be ones like that in every county. That is how we make cultural changes, and that's how we show people, hey, you can do this in a libertarian way. So that's the message that I think that we should be putting out there, is not that we're like these negative people that just hate everything. We want people to be happier and freer. We're angry that they're not. And I think that's what gets lost in translation. So my final message to everybody is that, is do some good in your community. Figure out a way to do it without the government. Because when you have actual tangible evidence, this is how it's done, makes it a whole lot easier for other people to do it.
Fantastic. Live your free, live your life free. Thank you everybody for tuning in and for watching and for joining tonight. Give that button, big like button, a push, hit that subscribe button. Don't forget to comment and share with your friends. And thank you so much for tuning in, participating. Thank you, Eric, for coming on. This has been an actually productive conversation that I think so many more of our kind need to start having, rather than hating each other and fighting each other, because we're not each other's enemies. And we need to make sure we see that going forward. So again, thank you all for watching, listening, tuning in, and until next time, be free. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Subversive. Make sure to like, subscribe, and turn on notifications to get alerted every time we go live on YouTube. And make sure to leave some comments and reviews on whatever platform you listen on to let me know what you thought of this episode. And a huge thanks and shout out to our sponsors and the awesome members of the Insurgency on Patreon. If you enjoyed this content, you can join the Insurgency on Patreon by following the links in the description for patreon.com/odama. And if you can't catch the show live, you can always catch it the next day on YouTube, Odyssey, Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Breaker, CastBox, and wherever else you listen to your favorite podcast every day. So until next time, everybody, be free.